Welcome to the Abbey Lane Beatles podcast. I'm your host, Michael M. Thanks for tuning in again. So today's episode is going to be about the Beatles in Canada. Now, we all know the world basically rocked in February 1964 when the Beatles invaded America and appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. The story of how they got there is a fascinating tale in itself. I could literally make dozens of episodes covering the various different ways in which the Beatles became the Beatles. Today's story is going to be about the Beatles in Canada, and for me, it's a personal favorite. I was born and raised in Toronto, and I'm a very proud Canadian, so it only makes sense that I want to know more about the connection between the two things that I love the most. Now, I think, like anyone, we can all get kind of excited when we hear about a favorite band or celebrity and a connection that they might have to where we live. It somehow makes it more real. Now, every time I hear or read something about a Beatles connection to Canada, or Toronto in particularly, I get excited. When we can connect a person to a place that we know, that connection becomes that much stronger. Now, I've come across a lot of cool tidbits about the Beatles as a group or as individuals in Toronto and other parts of Canada many times. I have lots of stories, and I like to share them with people. I always thought I had a decent amount of knowledge. That was until 2016, when a book came along that completely blew my mind. It was a book like none other that had come before. The book dived deep into the Beatles' connection with Canada, and it left me looking at my old self with the information I had at the time and laughing a little bit. The book is called The Beatles in Canada, The Origins of Beatlemania. It is an absolutely amazing book. Now, it's the first of two volumes, the first book referred to as The Red Book. This first book is one of the finest books I've ever read, regardless of its Beatles content. It's very detailed and jam-packed with so much incredible information. It's a book I would not only recommend to Beatles fans, but to any music history buff. It covers such things as production and distribution of Beatle records in Canada, including details like the manufacturing plants and their locations. It also has some great music history of the 60s in Canada. It also provides some great music history in the 60s in Canada, including early pop bands, and mentions the likes of Randy Bachman and Neil Young. It is the definitive Beatles timeline in Canada. And along with that timeline, there are tons of little side stories one might never have thought of. In the book, there are many fascinating key figures in the Beatles in Canada story, and I want to talk to you about some of them. So we'll start with Paul White. Paul White was with Capitol Records of Canada from 1957 to 1978. Paul started the Capitol as a stock person and worked his way up the chain very quickly. He would become the vice president and A&R person by the early 60s and would be responsible for introducing the Beatles to Canada in 1963. Paul would also introduce many artists to Canada at his time at Capitol. He also discovered Anne Murray. His story is a great one, and I highly recommend reading about him more. I've become such a big fan after reading about him. He was an important figure in Canadian music, and I'm happy to be able to talk about him. He unfortunately passed away in 2018, but we'll always continue to remember him and to share his story when we can. The next person I want to talk about was Sandy Gardner. Sandy was a journalist at the Ottawa Journal, and he became the first journalist in North America to review the Beatles in March 1963. His name and comment would also appear on the Canadian LP, Beatlemania with the Beatles, in November 1963. He introduced the term Beatlemania to North America, although the term was first believed to be coined in October 1963 in Liverpool. The next two people I want to talk about were DJs. First one was Dennis Corey from Winnipeg. He was a DJ at CKY. And Roy Sonnen. Roy was a DJ at CFRB in Toronto. Now, the debate of what DJ brought the Beatles to North America airways has always been a good conversation piece. Paris covers the topic with great detail. Now, both men reported to have played Love Me Do within a month apart of each other. Corey in November 1962 and Sonnen in December 1962. The debate is a good one, but regardless, both plays ensured the introduction of the Beatles. The last two people I want to talk about were Trudy Metcalf and Don Hester. They started the Beatles fan club after receiving permission to do so from NEMS in September 1963. It would be the first organized Beatles fan club in North America. Trudy and Don would go on to meet the Beatles in February 1964 and spend time with the Beatles going over fan mail. and photos of this can be seen in the Red Book. The story of the Beatles fan clubs is another that is covered in great detail in the Red Book. Reading the tales is like reading a Hollywood story, where there was talk of radio stations trying to recruit fans and to start rival fan clubs. Very interesting stuff. Now, when it comes to the Beatles in Canada, there were a lot of firsts, and I want to give you a good timeline of some key dates, and there is a lot of firsts. So 1962, as mentioned, Love Me Do was played in Canada late in the year, making its North American radio debut a month after its UK release. February 1963, Love Me Do is released by Capitol Canada. It marks the first North American release of the Beatles on vinyl. It was closely released to American release by VJ Records, as Capitol Records US had passed on it. The part I love the most is that the Canadian release is the version with Ringo Starr on the drums, and the VJ issue is the one with Alan White. So that in itself is pretty cool. March 1963, Sandy Gardner's review appears in the Ottawa Journal. April 1963, CKOC in Hamilton lists Please Please Me in their charts. June 1963, the Beatles UK fan club announces the creation of a Canadian fan branch in Montreal. September 1963, Trudy Metcalf launches the Beatles fan club in Scarborough, Ontario. Now, important fact is that Canada organized the first Beatles fan club in North America. October 1963, both the Toronto Star and CBC News mention the Beatles, and the Beatlemania with the Beatles LP is released. November 1963, articles appear by Alan Harvey of the Halifax Chronicle-Herald and Sandy Gardner of the Ottawa Journal. This is where Gardner mentions Beatlemania. January 1964, the Beatles appear on the Jack Parr Show, which is shown on Canadian cable. February 1964, the Beatles appear on the Ed Sullivan Show. Twist and Shout LP is released in Canada. And Trudy Metcalf and Don Hester meet the Beatles at the Plaza Hotel in NYC. March 1964, All My Loving and Twist and Shout are released as singles a week apart on March 9th and the 16th. August 1964, A Hard Day's Night makes its North American premiere in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Now, an interesting fact, Randy Bachman of the Guess Who and BTO fame attended that premiere. The film would also be shown in Toronto, Vancouver, and Montreal that month. And the Beatles finally come to Canada for the first time with their concert at Empire Stadium in Vancouver, BC on October 22nd. And September 1964, the Beatles perform at Maple Leaf Gardens on the 7th and Montreal Forum on the 8th. And that brings us to the end of the Red Book after the Beatles' first Canadian tour. So now I want to introduce today's guest, Piers Hemmingson. Piers Hemmingson has been a longtime fan of the Beatles since seeing them in early 1963, and he could vividly recall seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. He has published earlier highly respected reference books about the Beatles' recordings in Canada. His reference books have sold to Beatles fans around the world, and they have been acquired by music libraries for collections in Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto, and elsewhere in the world. A prime minister, and yes, even a world-famous Beatle, have acquired his Beatle Canadian reference books. His reference books have been used by researchers at EMI, Capitol, and MPL due to their incredibly detailed information on Beatles music releases in Canada. He's been a regular contributor to the British Beatles Fan Club magazine and has provided articles over the years to Goldmine magazine and Record Collector magazine. He's also contributed to some of Bruce Spitzer's books, where they have some Canadian content. He's provided detailed archival research and special project assignments for EMI Music Canada and Universal Music Canada. Over the years, Piers has met and interviewed many important people connected to the Beatles. So without further ado, please welcome Piers Hemmingson. Hey, Piers, how are you?
I'm terrific. Thank you for having me today.
I'm so pleased to have you here. I've been a longtime fan of yours. I've followed you for many years on Twitter. You've always been very helpful as far as if there were any questions related to the Beatles on Twitter, you were always ready to lend a hand and to help out. And I'm really excited to have you here today to talk about your book. I talked a bit about how great the book is, how detailed the book is, and just honestly, just how overwhelming it was when I first opened it up, just because of the vast amount of information. So what made you decide to do the book?
Well, that's a loaded question. I've been a Beatles fan since early 63 when I was just a schoolboy in England, and I saw them on television. So I bought all their, not every record, but most of their records as they came out through the 60s. Once it got to the early 70s and the Beatles had packed it in, I was still collecting records, and I was living in Ottawa or just outside of Ottawa, and I used to go to a store called Arthur's on Bank Street in Ottawa, and they would have a selection of used records, used tapes. And I slowly realized that, you know, there was something interesting about original Beatle records. So, you know, they were repressing them, of course, in the early 70s. And I thought, well, there's got to be information about, you know, what is a first pressing, what's different between a mono and a stereo. So I really made an effort to, you know, not hoard, but collect a pile of what I thought were interesting Canadian records. And I think it was 1974. I took an overnight train from, Ottawa, Montreal, New York City. And I dragged this big bag of Canadian albums down to Greenwich Village, a couple of stores there, Village Oldies, Bleecker Bob, I think was his name. And at every one of those stores, they told me Canadian Beatle records weren't worth anything, that they had no value to collectors in the States. So that put a huge chip on my shoulder. I had to drag that Let It Be box set and what I had a Life with the Lions. I had Tony Sheridan and the Beatles on MGM. You know, all Canadian pressings, different looking records to what.
Right.
But basically, when they looked at them, they thought, "Oh, these aren't worth anything. They're garbage." I remember that Bleecker Bob said, "Get them out of here." You know, that I was really offended by how offensive the guy was. You know, here I was, I come all the way from Canada.
Oh yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe I could trade these for a Butcher cover or something, but no such luck, no such luck at all. Anyway. I didn't walk away. I had to buy a Beatles. I bought a Beatles Butcher poster. You can see it on the back wall behind me. I don't know if you look at it there.
Noticed that. Yeah.
Folks on your podcast can't see it, but yeah, it's the word is incredible. Anyway, I think I paid $5 for it, but that put a chip on my shoulder, and I think I kept going in and out of the Beatles over the years. And then around the 1990s, I worked in the UK for a number of years, and I collected some more Beatles records from over there. And I came back to Canada, and I thought, okay, there's really good books coming out by Mark Lewisohn, by the American Beatles author Bruce Spicer. And I was starting to help them with what they were doing, just as a hobby. And then I put together the Canadian discography books, I think starting in the late 90s into the early 2000s. And, you know, you have to work at this. As we were saying earlier, you got to dig around and find a lot of this material. And then that led me to Paul White. And once I'd made kind of contact with Paul, he was very helpful. And I thought, I can't just leave it at a discography. I've got to get into the history of what really happened, who were behind all of these great Canadian records. And then, you know, that led to, you know, one to the next, you know, the radio stations, the manufacturing of the records. I know you're going to ask me this question later on about the next book, which I'm really excited to talk about. I wanted to make as definitive and complete as possible. So the getting access to the fan club information and Trudy Metcalf and how she put things together here in Canada with the first fan club in North America, really, and her going to meet the Beatles at the Plaza Hotel because there was no U.S. fan club. So there was, the more I got into it, Michael, the more I found out that the history was a really good story. So every country, I'm sure, has its own unique story about how the Beatles music invaded their country and how it culturally changed things. So it's been my real pleasure to write about that story for Canada. So that's the long and winding road to how I wrote the book, the first volume. And of course, I was thrilled to get Mark Lewison and Paul White to write the forewords for the Red Book. I call it the Red Book. And then, of course, there will be a Blue Book. And of course, when, I don't know if I'm out of order here, but yeah, I'll leave it at that.
No, yeah, absolutely. No, you answered my first two questions, all in one, which is fantastic, which is okay. Basically, how did you start? And you just, get it all, which is great.
Yeah.
And yeah, I love the forewords and that was one of the things, seeing, a foreword by, Mark Lewison and mm-hmm. as, big Beatle fans and fans that read books and know the history, will sort of be in awe of Mark Lewis, and he is, mm-hmm. And of course, this mm-hmm. is certainly no offense to any authors out there or yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really is, I think, the definitive Beatles authority. Mm-hmm. And to me, when I saw that forward, that spoke alone without even getting any further in the book.
Yeah.
How good this book must be. Because Mark doesn't... I don't think he attaches his name to too much other than himself. And to see a foreword by him in your book must have been like just an absolute thrill for you.
Yeah, well, I've been, in touch with Mark for many years. We've become good friends. And my first encounter with his Beatles Live book was in the 1980s. And I was on a holiday I was looking for something to do. I went to the local library where I was, and I saw that book on the cart of new books, and I thought, I got to read this. This is all of their live appearances, and so that led me to get in touch with Mark. And of course, he did the famous recording sessions book and the Chronicles, and yep. I was in touch with Mark. Many times in England, and we've kept in touch. And I know he's busy working on the second volume of his trilogy. And we all know that whatever yes. he's going to come up with is going to be is going to be worth the wait, even if it's a long wait.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. I know people are really eager to get to that. Mm-hmm. So. You've previously written three Beatle reference books in regards to their music in Canada. Mm-hmm. So you had a lot of information, as you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. Now, once you decided to do specifically just Beatles in Canada, how much more research did you need to do?
A lot. I basically had to go through, the library resources. Many newspapers are slowly getting, into the online world. But for me, unfortunately, I had to go through the old fashioned road of microfilm. And I think that sheds years off your life, too, because it's just a very painful. I get seasick going through all the microfilm. But I really wanted to make sure I went through the major sources and even some of the smaller sources to get the Canadian story, because that's how it was told. It was told through the Canadian press. And so from Montreal to Vancouver, Halifax, Toronto, London, Ontario, Ottawa, I wanted to make sure I had the kind of feel for the fact that Canada is a huge country and that there were pockets of interest in the Beatles early on. And, the good thing for me was that, it was about 4 or 5 years of pure, hard slogging research to do that Red Book. but I learned so much on the way through that when I came to do the Blue Book, you know, which is I call the evolution 1964 to 1970, I had it down. And yeah, you're never going to get all of it, but I did what I think is as good as you can. And there's only so much you can put in a book. So yeah, the research side of it took about 5 years per book each. So you're looking at 10 years of a decade of work and interviews. Of course, the interviews are the best part of doing any kind of book like this, because you get to talk to the people who were there. Some have better memories than others, but the last interview I did was last year for the Blue Book, was with Hunter Davies, who did the first, well, that only authorized biography of the Beatles. So it was a real treat to get to sit down at his house and get to know him and understand how he got that gig from Brian Epstein. And it was, if you were going to look at a slice of time to write a Beatles biography, he was in the studio during Sgt. Pepper and for, I guess, early stages of the White Album. And just
amazing.
Well, he's a great writer too, so no question. I mean, what Mark Lewisohn does and what Hunter Davies did are two different things, because there were two different phases in history, but they're both classics,
right,
in my opinion.
No, I agree 100%. And yeah, they're from two different things. And, you know, whereas Hunter's book was in the thick of the things. He's like, I'm writing about the story, but like, I'm in it now.
Yeah.
And Mark is like, well, here's what happened.
Yeah. Right? And if you go to if you go to the back of Hunter's book, you know, he's got that whole section of stuff that really puts you into the picture as it was happening. So yeah, he did the interviews in Liverpool and things like that. But it was, if you're really into it, go to the back of his book and you'll see, it'll take you right back to that time.
Right. So, you know, you mentioned the 5 years, for each book. Did you hit any major roadblocks in any of your research, like where you happen to find out about something, but you couldn't get any more, or you sort of got stuck?
The major roadblocks, I mean, I set a high bar, so I wanted to get as much information as I could. The real roadblocks were EMI owned Capitol Records in Canada. I did get some great sales information from the UK, from the EMI records. Corporations, companies in Canada in the 60s didn't know that what they were doing was historically relevant, so they didn't keep their paperwork. So I did have good fortune to go through paperwork at Universal Music here in Toronto, but much of it really only started in the 70s with all the reissues. So I gather really much of the stuff from the 60s is no longer available. Much of that was donated by Universal to, I think, the University of Calgary and the National Music Center out there in Alberta. And I've had I had access to some of that before it was shipped over there. There's some interesting things. You know, they've got a master tape for Rubber Soul and things like that. But they're later. Wow. They're not the original. When I went through the tape library at EMI in the 90s, I held, you know, the boxes for Beatlemania and Twist and Shout and Long Tall Sally. The boxes were the original, but they'd replaced the original mono tapes inside with, you know, later stereo tapes, you know, high quality stereo tapes. So somewhere along the line, those original tapes either were sent back to the UK or were just discarded. But that was, for me, was that's where it, ground zero, is that those tapes and the singles that were made in Canada were sent directly to Canada from EMI. They didn't go through that sort of Capitol Records in Los Angeles and then back up to Toronto. So what you were looking at was stuff that
right.
Paul White had requested. He'd put a telex together and say, hey, I want this on an album. I've already put out with the Beatles, and I didn't put out Please Please Me. What can we do now? So they created these custom records for Capitol of Canada, Twist and Shout and Long Tall Sally. And those are, to me, the difference between the Capitol story in the U.S. and, of course, the Capitol story we have up here. Those records have more tracks on them. I think the sound is quite superior in their mono format. They never did original stereo tapes for those two records. But just the archival aspect of it is fascinating to me.
Yeah, that was, you mentioned the things about, record keeping, and that definitely, I think, would be one of the hardest things for a researcher. I know that was an issue that Terry Crane had when he was, investigating all these, the Beatle merchandise. He says some of these companies aren't around. And even if a company's still around, it has evolved so many times, they just didn't keep records. So I definitely hear you there. And just the paperwork just not being there, and you sort of having to dig deeper or go a different route.
Well, there's the good thing about it was that there's like breadcrumbs. So, you do find little things that lead you to what I call the truth, or, if you have three things that point to it, those three things will, if they're reliable, you can really draw the picture from, even if you don't have the original document. So release dates, there could be an original release date for a Beatle record in Canada, but, it took time to get a brand new record shipped from Smith Falls to Kelowna, BC, or to Newfoundland. Like, you could say the original release date of Love Me Do was February the 18th, 1963, but when did those singles get into the shops, and it could have been weeks. Right. Yeah, so things are not black and white for release dates. But when you get into the days of, let's say Rubber Soul onwards, the release dates are pretty well managed by Capitol. Everybody wanted it the day of the release. So, yeah, they did a pretty good job in Canada of getting records out to stores within 24 hours. And it was like a Swiss watch, I think.
Right. So, during all your research, this is sort of a fun question. What was the coolest thing you discovered that you didn't know about?
Are you talking for the red book or the blue book?
For either.
Okay.
Let's focus on the red book. Yeah. Let's focus on the red book. And,
I'd say the fact that, the Beatles fan clubs were established in Canada first, and that the two girls from Toronto were flown to New York to hang out with the Beatles. The Beatles were always really good at looking after their fans or fan clubs and fans.
Right.
So Brian Epstein knew that the Beatles were doing well in Canada. He knew that they had fan clubs in Canada, and this sort of thing where the two girls could come to New York City, hang out with the Beatles at the Plaza Hotel, have their pictures taken by Dezo Hoffman sorting bags of fan mail, having their pictures taken.
Which is in the book, which yeah. If fans pick up a copy of your book, they mm-hmm. can see that.
Yeah. So I think that was the most interesting thing if you had to, rank them, but there's a lot of other interesting things. The idea that records were shipped from Canada to the States, boxcar loads of Capitol singles moving across the border to the States, Capitol didn't do anything about it because, they really wanted to clobber all these VJ records, and they didn't care if they came from Canada or from Yugoslavia, as long as they had the Capitol logo. But at some point they had to say enough is enough. These things are up on the cash box and Billboard charts. in April of 64. All My Loving, Roll Over Beethoven, Love Me Do. They felt that, okay, we're going to win our lawsuit against VJ Records and we're going to reissue all this stuff ourselves. So, yeah, the letter that came from Alan Livingston to Capital of Canada's Geoffrey Racine suggested that, okay, we got to harmonize the Beatles catalog. That was circa April of 64. That was just a business decision. Yeah, Canadians would have loved to see unique Canadian albums after Long Tall Sally, but it didn't make any sense. So, you know, that's the way it was. There was just that nice window in 1963 and early 64 where Capital of Canada put out these amazing Beatle records. They started with Love Me Do, and they didn't miss a beat. Whereas in the States, you know, Dave Dexter Jr. didn't like Love Me Do, didn't like Please Please Me, didn't like From Me to You, didn't like She Loves You. So not sure, you know, if he was right or wrong, if they'd sold records, if they'd put them out by the Beatles, but that kind of makes it an interesting story in the States as well. You know, the Swan, the VJ, the Tolly, all of those weird labels, very collectible now. Because of that Capitol in the U.S. Passing on the Beatles. You know, they Dave Dexter chose to release a record by Freddie and the Dreamers in 63, but not the Beatles. Go figure.
Right. And that's something I mentioned at the top of my episode. I talked about how, you know, all these Beatle events in North America and how many of these firsts were in Canada. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that the U.S. had, the U.S. and Capital U.S. really had no interest in the Beatles at first, and that's why they passed, and that's why you had these VJ records, mm-hmm. Which didn't sell well, is my understanding. And of course, once full Beatlemania hit in 1964, it seemed like the Capital U.S. was ready to take all the credit for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's. There's nothing taking away from the success of I Want to Hold Your Hand in the States and the Beatlemania that was launched there by Ed Sullivan. I mean, yeah, the Beatles charted in Canada in December of 63, but it still took Ed Sullivan to push the Beatles into every living room in Canada.
Yeah, no, and I absolutely agree with you. So just in the last question, you mentioned that letter that Alan Livingston sent to Geoff Racine, basically saying, so here's what's going to happen. We're going to decide on when singles are going to be released, and we're going to pick those. And this virtually took away Paul White's control. Now, you mentioned in the book that, you know, Paul was upset, and as well he should have been after all he had done, which mm-hmm. we now know thanks to your book. Mm-hmm. Did you ever talk to Paul about that in more detail and expand on like how he felt and what he was thinking at the time?
Yes, I did. And Paul was very open about that. I mean, it was just, you know, he had a job to do and he was the A&R guy for Canada, if you will. He got the same records from EMI in the UK that Dave Dexter did. But the good news is that Paul saw the British invasion as a huge opportunity for Capital of Canada. So, again, you know, the folks in the States at Capitol passed on the Hollies, they passed on the Animals, they passed on Billy J. Kramer, you know, but Paul kept them all. So the British invasion releases in Canada are incredible. Swinging Blue Jeans, the early Herman's Hermits, all of them, really, Manfred Mann. The Yardbirds, they were all out on Capitol in Canada. So they had a monopoly on the British invasion. If you look at all of the sizzle sheets that Paul put together every week, when you say he didn't have control over the Beatles, he had control over the Beatles releases in Canada. So he would be the guy who would write to all the radio stations, say, here's what's coming. And they're a fascinating record. I mean, he really pushed hard for I'll Be Back to be a single in Canada because radio stations were saying, hey, this is a really popular song. Our listeners are asking us to play this song. How come it's not available on a single? Well, they got 8 days a week. But they could have probably done another couple of singles off Beatles 65, in my opinion. And I think in my discussions with Paul, he was a little bit bruised by that letter that came from Los Angeles. But I guess letters came all the time from Los Angeles. So, you know, when it came, you get to the Butcher story that I have in the Blue Book, another letter came, you know, so there was always something coming from the tower, as Paul called it. He called it the tower. And, right. You know, he had two bosses. Yeah, yeah. He had two bosses, right? He was dealing with some pretty interesting people at EMI as much as he was in England, as much as he was dealing with the people in the tower. So he had two masters, if you will. But there was a blessing in disguise, right, is that Canada got all these great releases directly from EMI in England that never got a release in the States. So one example nobody's ever heard of is Manfred Mann. They did an instrumental album in the UK, never got released in the States, but Paul put it out in Canada. The Dave Clark Five had an instrumental album in Canada. Nothing like that appeared in the States. I didn't even mention the Dave Clark Five. They were huge. You know, if you were either a Beatles fan or a Dave Clark Five fan for a period of time in 64, they were massive. Right. Yeah, so to answer your question, he wasn't really too upset about it, but at the time he was upset. You know, it was like he'd built a reputation, and all of a sudden here comes a letter, and as he said, his word kaput, you know, the thing was kaput. And it must have hurt, but you know, sales-wise, they did really well out of the Beatles in Canada.
Yeah, it was just in reading through the book, and it's sort of like you would get to that part of the book where your heart sort of sinks, and it was reading about that letter when you've read all this point of like how far Paul White had come along and the things he had done, the sizzle sheets, the just like he was on top of it. So that absolutely must have been just sort of, as you said, a sort of a knock from the tower saying, hey, settle down there. But he still did amazing things, which you've brought to life in the book. Mm-hmm. So another question I have is, in the book you talk about Brian Epstein knowing about the Beatles' growing popularity in Canada as early as January 1963. And this sent Brian to Alan Livingston at Capitol Records to secure the release of I Want to Hold Your Hand. So my question is this, and of course it may be purely speculative, is do you ever think at any point Brian considered signing with Capitol Canada?
Well, he did. I mean, Paul White had to sign the Beatles to a contract to have their records released in Canada. So that's true. Epstein signed with the Beatles to Capitol in Canada in early 63. There is a famous, I don't know how famous it is, but in I think it was in Mersey Beat, the Liverpool newspaper put together by Bill Harry. And they summarized the Beatles' accomplishments at the end of 62. And it was called 1962, the Year of Accomplishment for the Beatles. And they noted in that big one-page feature on the Beatles all the things that had happened to the Beatles in 1962, including their first single on Parlophone. And then they had a little piece about predicting things for 63. And one of them was that Love Me Do was going to be released in Canada. So he knew. You know, that was being signed to Capitol of Canada. Unfortunately, Capitol of Canada was a shrimp compared to Capitol in the USA. The real prize for Brian Epstein was, you know, getting a number one in the States. But if you look back at December of six or November, when Epstein comes over to New York City with Billy J. Kramer, there's an awareness that the Beatles records have been released in Canada. He brought over an acetate of I Want to Hold Your Hand to play to the Eastern Capital folks. That triggered what eventually forced, if you will, Capital of the States to release I Want to Hold Your Hand. Dave Dexter claims, you know, it was him, but I don't know if it was. But I think Brian Epstein had been in discussions. Well, I know he'd been in discussions for the Beatles to tour Canada in February of 64. So we have that audio recording on the audio disc of Chum interviewing Trudy Metcalf in December of 63. And she mentions that the Beatles were booked to come to Maple Leaf Gardens in February. So clearly there was a move by promoters in Canada, Toronto, to get the Beatles to come to Maple Leaf Gardens. So somehow, you know, the bigger prize was Ed Sullivan. So that was put on the back burner. But Epstein clearly was aware of what was going on in Canada, that they had the fan clubs in 63, in late 63, that the records were selling, that She Loves You had hit number one in Canada in December of 63. So when you asked me the question about Brian Epstein being aware of Capital of Canada in early 63 versus I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is almost a year later, I'm sure he knew all the way through that these other countries, Sweden, France, Germany, Canada, U.S., exactly where each country was in terms of their sales of Beatles singles and their releases. And of course, he knew that the first album in North America was issued in Canada, was, you know, getting that on Capitol at the end of November of 63 was a big deal. You know, the first album, the first Capitol single, both here in Canada.
So, you know, we've talked about the Red Book, and it covers up until the end of the first Beatles Canadian tour in 1964. Yeah. And the Blue Book is going to cover from 65 to 70. And I love the naming of the books, by the way. It's very, very clever on your part. And I know Beatle fans will instantly know the connection. So, and I'm really looking forward to the Blue Book because at the top of my podcast, I talked about how, you know, people love having stories that connect them with their either their favorite celebrities or music band to where they live. And I have a lot of little tidbits of stories about the Beatles, but most of them are towards the late 60s. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure the Blue Book is going to be fantastic and as detailed as the Red Book. So how far are you on the Blue Book? Do you have an anticipated release date yet?
Well, I'm glad you asked because last week I sent the rest of my files to the layout edit person that I deal with. And so now I can tell you I've finished writing the book as of but a week ago. So your timing is great.
Fantastic.
And I'm hopeful we'll have something ready to look at in about 2 or 3 months. When I say that I can start working on the edits. So I'm anticipating spending a lot of time this summer on the final edits. I'd like to think everything I've written is all edited and good, but I know from the last time there's the devil's in those details, and you've got to get that right. I'm not going to give everything away, but there's some interesting stuff people will be fascinated to read about. I didn't get a lot of, I got a lot of firsthand interviews with people who interviewed the Beatles, of course, but the Beatles themselves did a lot of interviews with the press. So there's a lot of recorded Beatles interviews specifically done here in Canada. The toughest one for me was Brian Epstein. you know, tracking down anything that he did interview wise in Canada was hard, but I did manage to get a couple. So those are like diamonds.
That's fantastic.
Going back to your question about the red and the blue actually picks up in 64, not 65. So you're going to get the rest of, you know, the Beatles story record, the Beatles 65. They were issued in 64. And of course, I reckon Beatlemania peaked in kind of July and August of 64. After that first tour, Beatlemania is not at the same scale. People will be surprised to find that as you get into the later releases, not all were you know, you would think nowadays if a new Beatle record was released, it would go right to number one. Not all of them did as well as some other ones. So, you know, the White Album did amazingly well. Sgt. Pepper did really well. But records like Yesterday and Today were summertime releases. You didn't always do so well with a new Beatles release in the summer. Rubber Soul was an interesting revelation to me because there were it kind of brought in a new segment of Beatles fans. So whereas you had, you know, young girls in 64 going potty over the Beatles, Rubber Soul brought in those people who were a little bit older, who had, you know, been through the Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul, and Mary on the folk side, didn't like the Beatles when they first came around with Beatlemania, but they got into that introspective type of album of Rubber Soul, and they just became a more mature segment, if you will, of the Beatles buying market. So I wanted to get into the demographics a little bit, the you know, who was buying the records, of course, who was manufacturing, how you could buy them, the record club of Arm of Capital, which is how I got some of my Beatle records in the mid to late 60s. So, yeah, there's way more information in the blue book that I had to deal with versus the red book. The red book was more of a challenge because it's so long ago and nothing much was documented at the beginning of the Beatles coming to Canada. So once you get into 1964, everything they did is documented. So it's a lot easier from a research perspective to find information because there's a lot more of it. It's harder to distill it into a, you know, something that you can read. So that's a kind of,
so you know, I'm really, of all the people.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yep. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you want to finish?
Yeah, I'm just saying of all the, they're two different books altogether because of the different periods. And I think I broke it up the right way in Canada because you had this build up to Beatlemania and then you had this other story and you're bringing in, you know, John and Yoko coming to Canada three times. That is brilliant, but it's different from any other Beatles story in any other country. So we have some amazing, you know, the Bed in Montreal, the Rock and Roll Revival, and the War is Over launch in Canada. These are great. You know, John was still a Beatle when all this was happening. So, and there was no no thought. I mean, when we get into this new Peter Jackson film, there, you know, in January 69, there's no real sense to me that they're not going to be Beatles anymore. It's just they're going to do separate projects on their own. The idea of the Beatles breaking up, the movie was made in January 69. When I saw it in 1970, the Beatles had already broken up. So it was very sad to see the end of the Beatles. However, I think when they made the movie, and this is the challenge for Peter Jackson, is that he can spin it in a much different light. That they were, you know, happy together as Beatles, even though, you know, they were under a lot of, they didn't really, I don't think all of the Beatles liked the fact that they had to be in a studio at 8 o'clock in the morning making this music. How could it be spontaneous, you know, the way they'd done things before in Abbey Road on their own? It was different. And I think
that absolutely.
This is the challenge for Peter Jackson, is to make a film that is more uplifting.
So a little sort of fun question, because, you know, there are so many cool things in the book. There was some particular things that I picked out that I wanted to share with you and the listeners that are really exciting to me was Rich Manil had a radio station called CJRH that started in 1957. I thought that was very cool. Yep. And then the other thing was how Paul White went from this stock person to head of A&R very quickly. And it just, I was astounded by that. That, I mean, it was something like 6 years and he was basically running the show, which that would never happen in these days.
Well,
I just think it speaks to, and you talk, you have mentioned a few things in the book of just how motivated he was and how he came in and changed things that sort of helped him move up.
Well, I did a little more work on that aspect of Capitol Records of Canada. And I did interview some other folks who worked for Capitol in the 50s, and even as late as the 1940s, late 1940s, it seemed like it was a pretty standard practice for anybody who got hired at Capitol. They had to spend time in that warehouse. So Paul did start in the warehouse, but I think quite a few people did as well. And I think whether you spent a week there, if you're going to go into sales, they wanted you to know what the catalog numbers meant on the shipping dock, because if you memorize those, you know, catalog numbers of Oklahoma, The King and I, and those other top selling Capitol albums of the 50s, that was a springboard into understanding how you would be selling the products. So much like working in, I guess any industry, you know, if you got to know it from the ground up. I think that was the 1950s. You had to know the company, and the only way to start was at the bottom. I'm not taking anything away from
right.
Paul, because Paul was probably in that warehouse for about 3 months, and he didn't have he wasn't hired to be a sales guy. Other people that were hired to be salespeople started in the warehouse, but they probably didn't spend 3 months there. It was probably 2 weeks. But I think that was their that was their culture. It was their culture was to have people know what it was like to work in a warehouse.
And it makes sense. It makes sense to start up and so that you know how everything properly runs. You don't have to sort of ask questions.
Yeah.
Some of the other things that I really enjoyed were the Beatles connection. Right here where I live in Richmond Hill was George's uncle, Edmund French, living in Richmond Hill and working for Smith Transportation. I thought that was very cool. And then, of course, they moved to Toronto onto Don Mills. Mm-hmm. And then another story, which must have been a real joy for you to put into the book, was your own family connection to sort of Beatles.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's a story about your brother Randall and his meeting with DJ Roder Stanion. Mm-hmm. From CHOV in Pembroke, and that was in October 63. So Randall brings his Beatle records that he had brought back from England to share with the DJ, and almost immediately it created this groundswell of demand for Beatles music in the Ottawa Valley, which I thought was very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Randall, God bless him, he got me into the Beatles. I mean, he was the one who said, you got to watch this group. This was January of 63, we were living in England. We all went to the same school. I'm quite a few years younger, but he said, you got to watch this group on TV. And I saw them. And, you know, if I had to compare the Beatles in Please Please Me on Thank Your Lucky Stars or whatever it was to Ed Sullivan, there was day and night. And they were a scruffy group in the Please Please Me days. And they were completely transformed by Brian Epstein for Ed Sullivan. But Randall had this, always has had this really sort of, he's intensely interested in new music. And I remember even years before how impacted he was by the death of Buddy Holly. He loved Buddy Holly. And when we moved to England, he was looking at the new music in England at the time, you know, the Tornadoes and the Shadows and these sort of instrumental groups. And then the Beatles come along and he hears about them at school, and there's a great recording on the audio disc. My parents wouldn't let him go to see the Beatles because it was a school night, and my parents were fairly strict that way. But his friends did go, and you know, he cleverly bought Please Please Me it was the Easter weekend of 63, and brought that home, and I listened to the album over and over, and it was so different from everything else that was that we were listening to on radio at the time. But you mentioned Richmond Hill and Smith's Transport and George having family in Canada. Of course, his sister lived in Kirkland Lake, just near Kirkland Lake. And the first couple of visits to Toronto, George made sure that his family, you know, the Frenches and Louise and her husband and their kids, all those kids came to hang out with the Beatles at the King Edward Hotel. So, yeah, Canada had this kind of good feeling for the Beatles. John's wife, Cynthia, had a mother who was a nanny in Toronto just before the Beatles broke in the UK. And that's another interesting little side story. I love finding out all about those little family connections, where they lived. You know, I even went up to visit the house that Louise and her husband lived in outside of Kirkland Lake. That was interesting. The house is still there. George sending her postcards.
That's amazing.
Saying, I've joined a band called the Beatles, or I'm going to Germany. And his mom coming to visit George's older sister up there and buying cowboy boots that George then wore in Hamburg. And then John and Paul said, hey, what's this? We got to have cowboy boots. So they went out to some place in Hamburg and had their cowboy boots made to look like George's from Kirkland Lake. So all these little Canadian angles are kind of insignificant, yet for me, they were significant.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And again, it would be for me as well, like having a connection to something you love, to something you can see, something that's mm-hmm. tangible. Mm-hmm. It just makes it much more exciting. Mm-hmm. And seeing the pictures in there of, like, you know, the house where George's sister lived, it's exciting. And it must have been, even though many, many years have passed, for you to just sort of visit it and see it, it's like, wow, this is pretty cool. You know, there's stuff here that his sister found out mm-hmm. for the first time in these postcards and letters,
and getting Louise to open up about her time in Canada and meeting her a few times, and even once she came into one of my presentations at the Beatle Fest. That was a real treat, you know, and she had such fond memories of Canada. She was a young mom, and her kids were born up there. And I think she always felt some kind of, it was just a period of her life where she'd left Liverpool and gone to the back of beyond in Canada. You know, her husband was a mining engineer. What would that have been like? And to get postcards from your little brother talking about music happening so far away. And I think as well, George's mom sent George's sister the first Love Me Do record while she lived in Canada. So that was kind of a nice little connection as well.
That's very cool. So a couple more things I wanted to ask you. How cool was it? I mean, for me, hearing about it was very cool, so I wanted to ask you about it. How cool was it getting a letter from MPL saying that Paul had seen your book and he enjoyed it?
Yeah, well, that was exciting. We tried to get Paul to come to the book launch. He was planning a tour of Canada in, I guess it was 2016. So we were trying to work it out where we could have Paul come to the book launch in Smith Falls. So we tried with as much lead time as we could. We sent him like an early version of the book, and I know he played in Ottawa, and he played in Toronto, Just nice to get a letter and that he acknowledged the book. So very cool. Apple has been very supportive of what I've been doing, and it's just nice that you got to run stuff past them, but it doesn't happen quickly. But they are very supportive, and time moves on. So you're talking about stuff that happened 50 years ago. One of the interviews I did for ultimately the Blue Book was with Richard Lester, who had been the film director for A Hard Day's Night and for Help and How I Won the War. And,
right.
Asking somebody questions about things that happened a half a century ago is really a tall order, and you're asking them to remember things that happened on a morning of a day during the making of a film. I'm surprised people could even answer these questions, but he was very, very generous with his time. And the main question I wanted to ask him was whether he thought, John playing Musketeer Gripweed had any impact on his anti-war, because the film was really anti-war. He was generous and answered the question. So, yeah. All these interviews were just, I wish I could keep doing them, but you can't. You got to get the book to the people that are going to read it. That's the, you have to end it.
No, absolutely. So a little fun question.
Yeah.
It's something you mentioned in the book, buried with all these great little tidbits. Have you ever found out any more information on the reel-to-reel and the recorder contest from the Toronto press conference that Chum gave away?
Yes, I did. So for the Blue Book, I did fill in some blanks for that. I never did find out who or where the tape is, but I did find out the information about the 1 hour recording, and that was a program that was aired on Chum. It was a week or two after the Beatles had come to Toronto, and it was a Saturday night radio special hosted by Bob McAdory, and it was basically a recap of their Beatle Day in Toronto when the Beatles played at Maple Leaf Gardens. So it was basically a copy of the radio program that was put together for that Saturday. The date's in the book. I don't have it off the top of my head, but I was able to include some of that show on this audio companion disc for the Blue Book, which I think it's
right.
So it's basically some of the press conference. So there is, right now there's no really good audio quality complete recording of the Toronto press conference from 64, but at least some of it was incorporated into that Beatlemania, Beatles. It's called the Beatles in Toronto show that was given away with that tape recorder. So the show basically interviewed kids, talked about the Beatles, success in Canada, and then it also had those snippets of questions, asking about the Beatles, whether they smoked or they even drank and that kind of thing. But yeah, that. As best quality as I could find is on that audio disc for the Blue Book.
That's very, very cool. Definitely looking forward to that. So that wraps up about the book. And I want to talk a bit, it won't take up too much more of your time, but we talked about you do the Beatles walk in Toronto. And I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about that and maybe the places that you visit and what people can expect on the walk.
Okay. Well, right now everything's on hold, but, once I mentioned I've had my first vaccine, once I get my second one and hopefully everybody else does, we'll be starting up some more walks. I started the Beatle walks in 2015, and we ran them all until, 2020. But initially, I was sponsored by the British consulate here in Toronto, and they had a kind of a Beatles or a British theme that included the Beatles and James Bond and Doctor Who, and all kinds of things happening under one umbrella. And they asked me if I'd like to do some Beatle walks. I said I'd love to. So I started doing the Beatle walks. I think we had 7 of them in the first week back in 2015. We started off, I think we started off at Maple Leaf Gardens. But we did the King Edward Hotel, Maple Leaf Gardens. We did a number of other spots on the way. Some have been demolished now, unfortunately. But over the years, I've expanded right. those walks. I include Varsity Stadium, the Windsor Arms Hotel, where John and Yoko stayed in 1969. They also stayed at the King Eddie in 69. Yorkville, where they did the War Is Over launch. All kinds of places.
Right.
Marshall McLuhan's office, where he interviewed John and Yoko for an American TV show. I stopped there. I actually found the place where they created the poster for the Beatles 66 show. I don't know if you can, I'll move out of the way. You can see it right there, the poster.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So, yeah, I have a replica myself on my
good,
wall.
Good. And I was able to interview one of the people who worked for the company that made the poster. So I got the inside story for the Blue Book as well. So on the walks, the best thing for me is that you're getting a lot of people from a lot of different countries. You're getting Beatles fans. I know when it became it was sponsored by the City of Toronto after I did the walks for the British consulate. That was very successful. We did a whole bunch of walks in 2016, and then we kind of did different themed walks in the years that followed. But I try and do some of the I've been able to go right into Maple Leaf Gardens, which has been nice, you know, even though it's not exactly the same. The hockey arena is still there. It's just up a bit from what yeah. it used to be. People like going in there. Yep. I bring along a lot of photos of what took place back in 64, 5, and 6, and 69. And I've learned a lot just from people that have come on the walks. I've learned a lot about from people that were at some of these shows. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't living here at the time. So it's nice to hear from fans that were right. at the shows. And most of them tell me they couldn't hear a thing, that they couldn't remember any of the songs because it was just one deafening roar. And it was very hard to get a seat.
Yeah, that seemed to be a theme.
Mm-hmm. So
that seemed to be a theme with all the Beatles shows. They would say they couldn't even hear themselves.
Yeah. So over the years, I've been very fortunate. I mean, I believe I'm the first person to do Beatles walks in Canada. So it's kind of nice. Put on my Beatle resume that we started the walks. They're fun. And obviously we did try one in December one year to do the John Lennon walk. It was too damn cold. We were literally running from spot to spot because we were so cold. But even that was fun. You know, I learned my lesson. You can't run them in the winter. You have to have them, you know, weeknights in the summer are good. Saturdays and Sundays in the summer are good. But I've never had a complaint.
Well, it'll be nice when COVID's over and you can get back to that. And I'm definitely going to make it out and make time to come yeah. to the walks. I'd love to see all these places. I know there's, you know, you'll have different walks and different themes, mm-hmm. but I definitely want to hit them all. I think it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to make sure that I put in the podcast description, you know, your webpage and your Twitter so mm-hmm. that Good. Everyone can keep up on it.
Yeah.
And that perhaps people come to visit Toronto, they can sort of time it out so that they can do one of your Beetle walks.
I've done you know, specific special walks for people. Mark Lewison wanted his own walk, so I obviously Mark was interested in certain stuff, so I created a special walk for him. And other people that have said, okay, I'm visiting Toronto, can you take me on a walk? I'll do one-on-one, no question. So happy to do a one-on-one if you're interested.
Oh, absolutely. That would be an absolute thrill for me, I have to say. Yeah. So before I wrap up, Piers, I do something that I'm going to do in all my regular podcasts, which is it's a four question, which I sort of call get to know the Beatles fan. Okay. So I've got four questions for you. Mm-hmm. So who's your favorite Beatle?
Favorite Beatle? I think it's changed over the years. I mean, originally it was John. But I know with a lot of fans like myself, I have a new appreciation for George. You know, George is, he was the quiet Beatle, but, you know, in the 60s, it was John. I always felt Paul was like, the girls like Paul and the guys like John. Maybe there were some girls that liked John, I don't know. But I always say I never loved the Beatles like the way girls did. I loved their records. I wasn't in love with the Beatles for sure, but I just, every record that came along, certainly in the 60s, I really more identified with John, his songs, than I would say the Paul songs. So I guess my answer for you would be John, and with a new appreciation for George. Not to diminish Paul's contributions, okay. Of course.
No, and you know, in hearing you say it, it's the exact same way for me. You know, you've got your favorites for certain reasons, and then you have this appreciation. Like, I would always say Paul's my favorite, but there's that appreciation for George, which I didn't learn until many years later, just how amazing he was, which is a whole other topic for another show about, you know, how he was sort of repressed, but absolutely. I understand that appreciation for George. So do you have a favorite album?
That's a really hard one, but I think I have the emotional attachment to records, is high. Again, because I basically was into each one as it was released. I would say that Help was probably the one that really got me into a different Beatles sphere. In the beginning, I loved all the early stuff, of course. But once I saw the Canadian Help album, really, you know, oddly, I think Dave Dexter did something brilliant there. He brought in Ken Thorne. He added the incidental music. A lot of people don't like it, but I happen to love the idea of bringing in sitar and flute and classical music into the Help album, the Canadian Capital version. Hearing, you know, Lohengrin and the sitar and the flute and the fantasy, From Me to You fantasy, to me, I just thought that was brilliant. Then, of course, following that, Rubber Soul, I think it's a great album. Yesterday and Today was an album I think is, it gets buried in this Butcher thing where people forget that it's actually a really good compilation album. It had three tracks that were from the UK Revolver, had yet to be released. But it also had the great, you know, Day Tripper, We Can Work It Out, Yesterday. I mean, these were in stereo and good stereo. So I think that was a real positive release in 66. Revolver, great album. Probably at the time Played to Death on the radio. You almost got sick of Yellow Submarine and Eleanor Rigby. I think they were played so much on the radio. But when you got into stuff like Tomorrow Never Knows, She Said, For No One, there's some brilliant stuff there. You see that with the departure of Dave Dexter, and I think it's Bill Miller that gets credited for Yesterday and Today and Revolver for doing the North American versions of those. They were the last of the Capitol butchering, I guess, and then you got into Sergeant Pepper that was the same everywhere, and thereafter everything was the same. But
right.
Favorite Beatle album, definitely, probably that Help, Rubber Soul period. Yeah, I'm cheating, giving you two albums.
Okay. No, it's all good. It's definitely a hard question for a Beatles fan.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite song?
Well, I it would be a toss up between Norwegian Wood, which is John's song, and I love Michelle. Mm-hmm. Michelle is a great song. So I think those two are kind of fall in that same period that I'm talking about between Help and Rubber Soul. They're both great songs. My funniest memory of life at home was my father, who was a military man. One morning I was getting ready for school and my dad was whistling. He was whistling Michelle while he was shaving. I thought, that's weird. I said, my dad is whistling music that I like. It's my music. What's he doing? But that told me that the Beatles music was kind of had more appeal than I had originally thought. Yeah, so Michelle and right. Again, I'm giving you two instead of one, Norwegian Wood.
Excellent. And so the last one is, do you have a favorite Beatle look?
A Beatle look? Do you mean the
as
way
as far that... as, you know, their transitions from outfits to our time spans?
You mean the sort of fashion-y look they had, eh? Okay, so...
Yeah.
That's a tougher one because they went through so many changes and so many looks. I mean, they had that Dezo Hoffman look in 63. They had the tired look of late 64. They got into the sort of longer hair of 65 and 66. I'd probably say that period into the 66 period where they really had a cool Beatles look, like a Bob Dylan look. You know, it was the suede jacket. The cover of Rubber Soul would probably sum it up for me, was that they had that edgy, they were definitely different from everybody else. But of course, yep. You know, 100%. Later on, the Sgt. Pepper, the White Album, the Abbey Road. Abbey Road is a classic. Nobody can touch that picture. That is, you know, somebody told me when I was doing the interviews that, you know, Abbey Road wasn't a double album and didn't have a gatefold, but the picture sold the record. You know, the cover of the album sold that record.
Right. But absolutely.
That was a look, you know, four different people, four different outfits, you know, different going in the same direction, but still different. But for me, it would be the Rubber Soul look.
Those are all really great answers, Piers. I really, really wanted to thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
I've taken up over an hour of your time, which is so fantastic. I'm sure you're a busy man, and for you to be able to give me this much time has been fantastic. I'm going to put in my description and also tell the fans, where they can still find copies of the Red Book.
Mm-hmm.
and give a bit more information on that. And I'm also going to give information on your website and your Twitter, that if any fans want to reach out to you. I know you're always very open to fans and to ask questions. So I'm going to make sure they have all that information. I am really appreciative that you joined me today.
You're welcome. Twitter is probably the one that I use, most. I really don't spend any time on Facebook. Twitter seems to lend itself to what I do. So I'm happy to stay on Twitter. I will.
Well, then I'll make sure all the fans can reach out to you.
Sure. Good.
Pierce, thank you so much for joining me. You stay safe, and hopefully we'll talk soon after the Blue Book. Well, that was a really great interview. I want to thank Pierce once again. It was a really good chat, and I want to thank him for giving me so much of his time today. So I wanted to give you some more information on the Red Book and where you might be able to find a copy. So 1,000 copies of the Red Book were printed in early 2016, 200 hardcover and 800 softcover. And all copies were numbered sequentially. Now, there are still a few first edition soft copies available on eBay and Amazon. These copies are all hand numbered and signed by Pierce and come with the red audio companion disc found inside the back cover of the book. In the description, I'm going to give you links to both Amazon and eBay where there's current copies available for the book. Now, Pierce also told me that the UK European distributor Omnibus/Music Sales, up until a few weeks ago, they had 5 books left in stock in the UK. Now, the first 200 hardcover books were initially targeted to and printed for supporters of the Beatles in Canada book project via Indiegogo in late 2015. And Paul White signed those 200 hard copy books, and Mark Lewisohn signed 25 of them, roughly. Now, those are really hard books to come by, and most of those are likely in hands of true collectors. Now, there are really cool digital copies of the book, both on Apple and Google Books, and I will make sure that I put the description and the links to where you can find those digital books online. Now, the Beatles book, aside from me giving it much praise, has been given lots of really good ratings. It got a 4 out of 5 in Record Collector and Shindig as well, as other publications in the US and Canada have praised it. And the forwards in there by Paul White and Mark Lewisohn are really, really cool. Now, also in the description, I'm going to give you information on Pierce's website, how you can get a hold of him, which is www.thebeatlesincanada.com. Now, if you also want to know about the Beatles vinyl releases in Canada, you can check out a website that was co-founded by Pierce called Capital 6000. And that website is www.capital6000.com. And as Pierce mentioned, the best way to get a hold of him is on Twitter, and you can reach him at Beatles in Canada. That is his Twitter's handle. And on a final note, I just wanted to mention a little bit more about Paul White. You know, Paul White passed away in March 2018, but he was able to provide Pierce with some of his original paperwork and notes on the Capitol releases in Canada regarding the Beatles, as well as releases right up until the Let It Be box set that was issued in May 1970. So thankfully, Paul was able to contribute all the way through to the end of the Blue Book, which is absolutely wonderful. I know Pierce has something special planned in the Blue Book for Paul White, so really looking forward to that. Now, Pierce has mentioned recently on Twitter that he has finished the Blue Book in the sense of there's still some editing and, obviously putting the book together, but that's really exciting news. So hopefully sometime, maybe in the new year, not sure, we'll see the Blue Book. And I have no doubt it'll be just as great as the Red Book. I want to thank you again for listening. I hope you all stay safe. And until next time, bye-bye.